The information shared in this podcast is intended for entertainment purposes only. It should not be considered as professional legal advice or a substitute for seeking professional legal advice. Divorce, custody battles, domestic violence. These cases unfold every day in family courts. But the stories don't end in the courtroom. The courtroom is just the beginning. I'm Michelle Locke, and this is Love, Lust, Law. The series that dives deep into the legal battles fueled by love, lust, power, money, betrayal, and survival. But before we crack open the first season of cases, we need a proper introduction in family law. Think of this as Family Law 101, the basics. It's the first class you take in law school. It's the nuts, the bolts, the foundational episode to get you ready for what's to come. Joining me today is my friend, colleague, and executive producer of Love, Lust, Law, Jake Deptula. You have heard his voice for many years as the host of Love, Lust, Fear and co-host of Strictly Stalking. Unfortunately for Jake, he's going to have to embark on his first cross-examination. And y'all, he's going to put me in the hot seat. Jake, thanks for being here. Let's get to it.
Michelle, I want to know what led you to practice family law and how did that path evolve into becoming a judge?
I've always wanted to be a lawyer. My youngest age, I remember, was being 8 years old, and my parents went through an ugly divorce. I was second grade, Vista Hills Elementary, and my dad told me that he would disown me if I became a lawyer. Important to note that my dad was a surgeon. At that time, medical malpractice lawsuits were running rampant in Texas. It was before tort reform, and so he really hated lawyers. Plus, unbeknownst to me at 8 years old, my dad had already been divorced twice. On his third wife, and then subsequently thereafter, fourth or fifth wife. I don't know how many he had by the time he died. So when he said that, for me, that sealed the deal. And it's a little bit of, don't tell me I can't do something because then I'm going to show you I can do it. And that's very much my personality. You tell me no, I'm going to show you you're wrong. It was really the reason I became a lawyer. The minute he said, I'll disown you if you become a lawyer, I was like, done. At 9 years old, I wanted to be a lawyer because it was LA Law era. And I loved watching LA Law, even though my mom would shoo me out of the room when it was on, because it was inappropriate content for my age. But I remember just looking at that and judges and just wanting to make a difference. And I will tell you, I have never deviated from wanting to be a lawyer. So much so that I didn't even go to my own college graduation. Didn't go. I was like, I'm going to law school. What does it matter? I graduated from law school in May of 2002 and passed the bar. I think the bar exam was July. 3-day bar exam. By the way, those of you that are getting ready to take the bar exam, I'm jealous because it's gotten much shorter and smaller than when I took it. 3 days of testing. I think I almost walked out of the bar exam the first day because the first day was 400 multiple choice questions, 200 in the morning, 200 in the afternoon. Multiple choice has never been good for me. I inevitably narrowed down to two and always picked the wrong one. And so I think I didn't even know the answers to like the first 40 questions on the first part of the first day. And I walked out and I sat on a bench and cried. And I didn't think I was going to go back, but I talked myself into it. And I said, well, might as well go finish this off. So I say that to tell you this. I have basically spent 23 years practicing law as a divorce attorney. I was fortunate enough to be an associate court judge out in Far West Texas, presiding over the domestic violence court to handle protective orders. And I'm also the child of divorce. And after a 22-year marriage, I went through my own divorce. When I say I've lived through every side of divorce and family law and custody matters, I really have.
Was there anyone in your life that acted like a mentor to baptize you into what the legal world would become?
You know, I would like to say yes, but no. I learned by the school of hard knocks. The only thing that I did have one person tell me, his name was Jim Darnell, a really, really good attorney out in West Texas, but he practices all over the state and all over the country, quite frankly. He told me, we were at a dinner in New Mexico at Chopi's Mexican food restaurant. I'll never forget it. I was 15 years old. I remember the table we were sitting at. I can still go to that restaurant right now and tell you exactly where we were sitting. And he told me, because everyone knew I wanted to be a lawyer, he said, never forget you're a woman and don't try to be a man in a man's world. And I will tell you, that is something that I have followed to this day. I don't try to be anyone other than myself in a courtroom. I'm a woman. And so I go in with my power red lipstick on and whatever makeup I want to wear that day, but my nails are always done, my hair is always done, my makeup's always done. Not that that's necessary, but for me, that's how I feel good and comfortable about myself. I listen to Jim's advice. Never forget you're a woman.
What are some of the things that you didn't anticipate that you had to encounter, but you did encounter across this 20 plus year storied career?
So the beginning was a little more difficult because I was young. I graduated from law school and became a lawyer at 25 years old. And 25 is young. But you also don't realize you're young, because when you're a young attorney with that bar license, you think your stuff doesn't stink. And so you just don't realize that, we call it the gray-haired factor now, but there is some credibility that comes with doing it for a long time. So I learned that there are a couple ways to handle when you're being discriminated against because of who you are or what you are. And I'll never forget, I was 6 or 7 months pregnant with my middle son. And I had another attorney who's still practicing asked me to come sit on his lap. And it wasn't like just out in a public setting at a restaurant. We were in the court chambers where the judge's court coordinator sat, and the judge was right behind that door. And it was in front of other attorneys. It wasn't just he and I. He did it in a room full of people and say, hey, come sit on my lap. And at that point, I learned I could have two choices. I could have raised a giant stink and just all kinds of heck. But I opted not for that choice. I opted to smile, laugh, say, no thanks, and then remove myself from the situation. Because sometimes the first thing you think of is not the best approach given the circumstances. And you will find in life that things do come around full circle, and you remember those moments, but karma comes around. What I did find out about being a judge is that while it is a great job, it is incredibly difficult if you are in the area like that I practice, when you're dealing with either child abuse, domestic violence, stalking, harassment, because you hear the ugly of the ugly. And you tend to start thinking that everyone is ugly or everyone is mean and every relationship is terrible. And so being a judge is not easy. I'm very glad I had the experience. It made me a better lawyer today. It made me a better person. But that's really kind of where I got my start. I was young and I really just didn't deviate. I was going to go conquer the law world, and I tried to. I haven't done it yet, but I'm working on it.
Michelle, what exactly is family law and what types of cases fall under this area?
So family law is a very broad term that is used to cover cases that include divorce, child custody, grandparents' rights, child support, adoptions, terminations of parent-child relationships, and other matters that affect the family structure. So really, when you think about family law, it's anything that touches either children or the core family structure.
What kind of jobs exist in the field of family law besides being an attorney or a judge?
When we talk about who earns a living off of family courts, I got to tell you, number one would be court reporters, because they charge per page for transcripts. And honest to goodness, in family courts, we request transcripts. Really, almost every hearing I go to, I request a transcript about every hearing. Other types of jobs within the family law system, and you probably don't think about this very often, but financial experts. When you have complex marital estates, and what I mean by that, the simplest terms are, when you've got a community estate, the stuff that you've developed or acquired through the marriage, and it's a large estate, there's inevitably tracing claims, which means you have to trace it, whether it's community property or separate property. You have to figure out tax liability on dividing the assets in certain manners. I mean, there's just so many different parts on the financial side that CPAs get called in. There are actual like forensic accountants versus other accountants. I mean, there are specialties that focus on family law litigation in particular. And so you have those. You have business valuation experts. And so you've got to get, if the marital estate owns a business, that has to get valuated for purposes of dividing on divorce. We have real estate appraisers. Those get paid because you have to appraise, guess what? The marital residence to figure out who gets what. And so there are real estate appraisers that get paid by the parties, either one party or the other, to go appraise property. That's another part of family law system. We also have court-appointed, what we call guardian ad litems, which are typically appointed to look out for the best interests of the children. And those are usually, at least in Texas, they're licensed clinical social workers or their PhD psychologists, they're someone. And so they get appointed by the court and the parties have to pay them to make whatever recommendations they're going to make. In addition to that, we have family therapists that get appointed by the court to help reunify families. And those therapists get paid. And so in addition to that, you've got other PhD level psychologists that get hired to do forensic psychological evaluations. And those get to be expensive. But when you're looking at assigning rights and duties, you want to find out if one of the parents or both of the parents have any kind of personality disorders, because that can affect co-parenting and can also affect parenting. So when I say that there are lots of people that can be tied and really have an income based on the family law courts, it's not small. The other one you can think about, and people don't talk about this as much, but there's divorce coaches, which are people that don't even work in the family court system, but are hired by individual people to help them navigate their divorce. And they're actually called divorce coaches. You can look them up on YouTube, you can look them up on TikTok, on Instagram, but there are divorce coaches. And so there are really just a multitude of experts. One other expert that I'll talk about that makes some money that no one really thought about 10, 15 years ago, but think about now, are digital experts. Digital experts. I had a trial that involved digital experts because there were allegations that all of the pictures that my client had produced in discovery were fake or doctored or altered. And so we had to hire a forensic person on videography as well as pictures. And so we got into the depths and details of metadata. I've learned more about how to know whether a photo's been edited or not than I ever knew before. But that was something that most people wouldn't think about. Another one you have to think about, the people that sweep cars for monitoring devices, GPS devices, that's becoming really big in family law because people are putting on air tags or anything else on their spouse's car to find out where they're going. And so those are people that are employed by the parties in family law litigation. So, I mean, it can keep getting bigger. I mean, it really is. It covers a broad spectrum of jobs.
From your perspective, being someone who's been in the court, has dealt with hundreds, if not thousands, of divorces, what should someone know about marriage before they end up in family court with a divorce?
Oh, marriage, y'all, and I hate to take the romance out of it, is a business transaction. So while the lovemaking may be great, while those gooey, gushy feelings may be great, it is a business transaction. And when you get divorced, it is even more so a business transaction. Keep good records. Keep good financial records. I mean, that's number one. If you've got accounts in your name, keep the records. And hey, y'all, keep the records for a long time. Not just what the 7-year rule or the 5-year rule or the 3-year rule, whatever rule you operate under. Because I can't tell you what's going to happen if a 20-year marriage and then you have to go back and show what your value of your 401k was on the month before marriage. And so when you go into a marriage, what you definitely want to figure out is the value of all your assets at the time you entered in that marriage. And so if that means that you keep those records somewhere safe, safe deposit box would be my recommendation, then you keep them. Because otherwise, you may lose half your claims to a portion of your property that you had prior to marriage. I mean, the record keeping, I would say, is the number one rule. Prior to marriage, figure out where you want to live, consult with an attorney in that state to find out what the requirements are for divorce, assets, community property, gathering that information, because each and every state has a different requirements, rules, child support. For example, some states say that child support goes through college, some states don't. I mean, it's really important to understand the general rules and groundwork of divorce in the state in which you reside, because that's going to guide it. It also, by the way, should guide whether you're going to be a stay-at-home parent or not and how to protect yourself if you're going to make that decision to be a stay-at-home parent. Because while being a stay-at-home parent is great, what can go really wrong, because I see it in Texas all the time, is that they stay at home for 18 years and they get divorced, and it's now what? Because Texas is an anti-alimony state. And so it's really important to understand the laws of the state you reside in prior to marriage. And then And this applies a lot to Hollywood, but then you do the prenups. And then you got to figure out the prenups and if they're enforceable in various states, because some particular clauses in some states may not be enforceable in other states, y'all. I mean, it is super complex and a complete pain. And then you get run the chance of it may be a valid prenup when you drafted it, but it becomes invalid 10 years later because of some change in the law. I mean, it's just so complex. To go into it blind, I think, is a mistake.
That's a very complex issue.
It is a complex issue, but if you can't ask the questions, then should you really be getting married?
Michelle, what's the general process for getting a divorce start to finish?
So each state really has their own respective requirements for how you start your divorce process. That being said, the general rule is a petition for divorce has to get filed. Now, some states, it depends on how long you've been separated before you can file. In some states, it depends on how long you have what we call a cooling off period before your divorce can be finalized. And so that each state's going to dictate just how long that divorce process lasts. But what's going to happen is you file that petition for divorce. It's going to work its way through the system. And then at some point, you'll have a judge say you're divorced with a final decree. And that's the only way to get divorced is a petition and then a decree and the court says you get divorced.
What are the top five things people should know before filing for divorce?
Plan for the worst, hope for the best, and hope is not a tactic. Anything beyond the worst will be a pleasant surprise if you follow that. Know your finances, otherwise known as know the state of the union. And your marriage, make sure you know the state of your union. Remember, your divorce is a business transaction. Take the emotions out. Remember, the person you're divorcing is no longer your friend, your confidant, or your trusted person. Each party is looking out for their own best interests. Remember, this too shall pass. Buckle down, keep your head low, and you will get through it. There is light at the end of the divorce tunnel, even if that's a tunnel you never thought you'd have to go through. One of the most important things to remember is that anything can be Exhibit A in court. And so if you don't want something going in front of a court, then don't do it. That includes emails, texts, social media posts. Everyone thinks that picture with the baby holding the beer is a great social media post. Y'all, it's not in family court. Remember, even voice messages can be Exhibit A. Your notes on your phone can be Exhibit A. So when you leave that drunk message at 2 a.m. calling your spouse 18 different things under the sun and threatening to like slash their tires, guess what's going to be in court? And also, here are some common misconceptions about divorce. Number one, and this one is one that I tell time and time and time again, divorce isn't fair. Divorce has lots of four-letter words in it. Some begin with F, but fair is not one of them. There is no real such thing as an amicable divorce. There's always going to be someone that is hurt, someone that didn't want it. I have yet to see in all my years, and I'm not saying I won't, but I don't see very often one where there's not some resentment of some sort that appears during the divorce process or afterwards. And thirdly, it's not quick, y'all. It's not. You're just going to have to bear with it. When you tell your attorney, can you make it faster, make it faster, make it faster? Trust me, they would if they could.
Let's dive into custody and parenting time. How does someone go about filing for custody of a child?
It's no different than what you do when you file a petition for divorce to dissolve your marriage. You go down to the courthouse and you file a petition saying, hey, I want custody. Or in other cases, you go down to the courthouse and say, hey, I want to change to our custody and here's why.
What are the top five things parents should understand about the custody process?
So the custody process and custody litigation is difficult. It's emotionally taxing and it's expensive. And then you get a bunch of people involved in your life telling you how to parent. And that's not always so fun. And it is something that I probably wouldn't wish on anyone because it affects the very basics of your life. I mean, a court's going to tell you who pays what in child support. A court's going to tell you what your possession schedule is and how often you can see your child if you all don't agree. They're going to decide where people can live. They're going to decide who gets to make major medical decisions and educational decisions. And psychiatric and psychological. I mean, you're going into court and saying, hey, we can't get along. We need someone who will never know our family for more than a few days in hearings to dictate how our life's going to be until the children are 18.
What does the court look like when deciding custody arrangements?
Generally speaking, the court's always going to look for what is best for the child or children in the case. And usually what is best is a little bit different than what both parents want, except for in extreme circumstances. But generally the court's, and I tell my clients this, I say, court doesn't really care about you. Court doesn't really care about your ex. What the court cares about are your children and how they are shaped and how their lives are, because the court wants to provide consistency and stability for children, generally speaking. And so I think that's what the courts really look at, is the best way to maintain stability in an emotionally and physically safe environment.
Can you modify a custody arrangement?
So it depends on the state you're in, but I think most custody orders can be modified by courts just based on whatever the requirements are to, in order to change them. Like, for example, in Texas, there has to be a material substantial change in circumstances from the date of the rendition of the last order. So the date that last order was signed or a mediated settlement agreement was signed, there has to be a change from that date forward. It has to be material and substantial for the court to have the ability to modify it. So each state has its different standards for modifications. Some states will do if a kid's a certain age and wants to go live with the other parent. That may be grounds for modification. But generally speaking, you can always modify. Now, it's not easy, but you can modify child custody agreements for the most part, or orders.
Michelle, how is child support calculated?
So it depends on the state in which you live. Each state has its own child support framework that is established by statute. And there are typically ways you can deviate from what the guidelines in your particular state are. But that, again, is dependent upon each state. The courts will look at the needs of the children. Some states will go and say, you've got to pay child support through college. Other states don't, like Texas. There are different formulas to calculate child support. Some states will look at what one person would owe in child support, what the other person would owe, and the difference is paid. The other way that child support can be calculated is the court will look at a percentage of possession and then do some kind of formula based on who has how much possession and the percentage, and so figures out child support from there. And so it really just depends. Texas has a statutory formula, which is one child before the court, no other children, you're going to pay 20% of your net resources. If you've got two children before the court, it's 25% of your net resources. And then if you have other children outside of that that you're responsible for, then in those cases, at least in Texas, the percentage of what you would owe for the other family gets decreased. And then you have to take into consideration also health insurance, which most people forget about, but that usually somehow gets factored into the child support calculations as well. And as we all know, health insurance premiums don't ever go down.
What are some other financial issues that may come up during divorce or custody proceedings?
Oh, it's always going to be expenses related to the children. One of the biggest issues that I've seen come up recently, well, not recently, probably the last 10 years, is extracurriculars. Because we have all these select sports that we didn't have 15, 20 years ago. And these activities are costly and time consuming and involve lots of travel, typically, if your child is any good and on a travel team. And so what we're seeing a lot more now is the fight over who pays for extracurriculars. And so that's really a big one that didn't used to be a fight, but has very much now become a fight. I can't tell you how many cases I've had fights over select baseball in Texas. I mean, it's a thing.
Well, and that's one of the issues that come up, and we've seen this time and time again, is how often the children suffer in custody battles. I mean, even as a judge, what kind of things have you seen that have just either prepared families to unify in their custody settlements or tear them apart?
So what you see when you have people that are intentionally trying to be ugly to each other, which happens, the children get thrown in the middle. And what I wish people would realize is your children didn't ask for their parents to get divorced or to separate or not be together. They didn't ask for it. So why are you punishing them with your bad behavior? Because that's what you're doing. And so what I see happen is you'll have one parent overschedule the child so that the other parent's time is taken up by that sport. And if the child likes that sport and the other parent wants to spend time, then the child starts resenting that parent if they don't take them to their activities. And so it's a system designed for failure to make a child resent the other parent, or the other parent loses quality possession time. And so I had a judge tell me, and this is just the other day, as a matter of fact, said, well, you know, I prioritize possession time over activities. And I said, I understand that, judge. I said, but the real problem is my client knows these girls like these activities. And so I know that he's not going to remove them out of it. And I said, so the real problem is the only way to fix it is to give basically equal parenting time to both parents so that it does not interfere with quality parenting time. Or if it does, it affects both equally.
As both a judge and a lawyer, what has that done to open up your POV to both positions when you're facing one or the other?
My youngest is 10, and I hate to break it to y'all. Your kid's not going to make the MLB. Your kid's not likely to be in the NBA. And your kid is not likely to get a scholarship to college. And I'm not saying that to say your kid's not special and wonderful, but you got to look at the realities. And if that's the case, it's more important that they have a relationship with the other parent, because that's a lifetime relationship. Sports aren't typically lifetime.
We know that, unfortunately, domestic violence sometimes or perhaps often plays a role in family court. What legal protections are available to someone leaving a dangerous or abusive relationship?
It is a great question, because there are protections. About every state has some version of protective orders. And protective orders, generally speaking, are orders from a court that say a person can't come within 200 yards of you, or can't come to your home, or can't come to your workplace of business, or can't come to the kids' schools if you're a victim of domestic violence. Most states have what we call like emergency orders, so you can get an emergency protective order pretty quickly if some kind of domestic violence situation has occurred, unfortunately, in your household. Also, I would look at the definition of what family violence is. People think that you have to be physically hit for it to be family violence, and that's not the case. The general definition of family violence, I can tell you what it is in Texas, and I think most states have adopted the whole, it's broader than just being punched, because sometimes it's the threat and intimidation that you live in every single day that may rise to the level of domestic violence. For example, let's say your spouse could, because it can't happen to both genders, but let's just say your spouse hit you 10 years ago. But then the rest of the marriage, that spouse is telling you, well, you remember what happened on that date? Don't make it happen again. That, I think in most states, could rise to the level of domestic violence. And so I think it's important for people to really understand that family violence is much broader than just, I got a black eye. Also, I think there's been a development in the law because people are understanding how dangerous stalkers are. Some of the scariest cases I ever saw when I was an associate court judge were the true stalking cases, because there's a mental health component that you cannot fix with the stalkers. And at the end of the day, the protective order is still just a piece of paper that someone can walk through. Now, it does provide mechanisms by which law enforcement can arrest the person. That being said, it's still just a piece of paper. And so even if you have one, you have to be diligent. But I really do think that people need to be aware that it's just a little bit broader than he punched me, he kicked me, he hit me. Like, there is, it's much, much bigger than that.
When it comes to marriage and there are abusive instances, how important is it for someone to have that documented in the off chance that it's going to come up eventually in a family court situation?
That's a tough one for a couple of reasons, but documentation is important. But people need to understand is that you don't have to have a police report for it to be documented. And lots of people think, well, I didn't call the police, so no one's going to believe me. Most family law cases are he said, she said, or he said, he said, or she said, she said. I mean, that's just what happens in family law. And you don't need a police report to prove that you've been the victim of domestic violence. You just don't. Your testimony alone can be enough. And people think, well, really? I don't have to have pictures or bruises? I mean, while those things would be great and helpful, it's not a requirement because judges every day make decisions based on the credibility of witnesses. And that's the bottom line. And so the court's going to look at what you say, what he or she says, and then make the call on whether it's a believable story. That's why I always tell people, I'm like, it's so important to tell the truth and to own your errors. Like, for example, this is the biggest one I can give is, if you were wasted drunk and they hit you, that's still domestic violence. But if you have a drinking problem, admit it to the court. You fall on your sword when appropriate. You make sure that you own your mistakes because that is, well, I think it's important for your credibility, number one. And number two, I think it's important for the court to see that nobody's perfect. Everyone makes mistakes. And family law is so fact specific that it's just, this is what you have to do. But yeah, domestic violence is just, it's tough.
If there was an incident years ago and the victim didn't share it with anybody, didn't document it, obviously didn't file a police report, but it comes up in family court as sort of a weaponization against their significant other they're battling against, how often is that question based on the fact that they did not bring that up earlier in the relationship? And how much does that weigh upon the judgment?
I think it depends on the judge. I think it depends on the severity of what it was that you didn't share it. I mean, I know I've cross-examined on this. And it's like, well, you didn't tell your mother, you didn't tell your brother, you didn't tell your sister, you didn't tell anyone, you didn't file a police report. I mean, I've asked those questions on cross-examination. And so, yeah, it does. It does come up that no one knew about it. Now, can that chip away at the credibility? Yes, but not necessarily. I wouldn't say be afraid to go into it if those types of that behavior occurred. You get into it, and then typically what you find is that someone that is abusing you or has abused you in the past, the judges are aware of patterns of behavior, and especially patterns of behavior of people with personality disorders. And so they can see throughout your relationship how the control developed, how the abuse developed. Because as we all know, abuse is not just physical. It's financial, it's sexual, it's emotional. I mean, there are abuse is not just, I'll go back to it, it's not just he gave me a black eye. And so one black eye 20 years ago may have been enough to get you to be compliant with the rest of his abuse because you wanted to avoid getting that black eye again.
How do restraining orders or orders of protection work in the context of family law?
Well, it depends on the state because in Texas, we have protective orders. We don't really have restraining orders. And so, but quite often we'll have people say, well, I want a restraining order against that person. I'm like, well, it's called a protective order, not a restraining order, because temporary restraining orders are different legally, but that's a whole different discussion. But do they play in? Absolutely. I have quite often filed at the same time I file a divorce petition or request for application for protective order at the same time. They're handled together, but they still have different cause numbers. But yeah, I mean, you can file one with your divorce. In fact, you don't even have to file the divorce first. You can file a protective order first, get that put in place before you even handle the divorce or even get that started. Because a lot of states on the protective orders or restraining orders can address kid issues on those as well. And I know in Texas we can. They can issue orders that prohibit the person that's subject to the protective order. They can prohibit the offender from going to the children's school, from being able to pick them up. And that's a tool that you want to go give to the school to say, please be advised, this person is not allowed anywhere near the school. And so, yeah, you can absolutely do it. And if you are a victim, then I don't know why you wouldn't. I know money is an issue for lots of people. And every place I know that you don't get charged if you go seek help for protective order, it's usually handled by the district attorney's office or the county attorney's office or the comparable in your jurisdiction. And they usually offer it for free because they want to make sure that people get the protection they need.
So let's talk about options. Let's talk about working within the system. If someone is in need, what should they look for when choosing a family law attorney?
That's a great question, because the last thing you want to do at the end of your divorce is figure out you picked the wrong attorney. I actually did a blog on that in particular, because I sat in court when you can see the opposing side realize that wasn't probably the attorney that was best for me. It's never too late to change horses too, is what I will also tell people. People think once you hire one, you're stuck with one because the courts are going to think you look crazy if you change. No, the court's not. Now, if you're on attorney 5, 6, or 7, that's a different story. But usually a second change of horse isn't necessarily a problem. And sometimes even the third isn't, because don't forget, y'all, that the judges in that jurisdiction that you live in know the attorneys that do it. They've been practicing with these attorneys forever. And so they know who's good. They know who's bad. I mean, they know. If you're going to see an attorney that says, I've never lost in court, they're lying, plain and simple. You don't win them all. And if they're sticking to that story, they either don't ever go to court, so they've only had one hearing and they didn't lose that one, or they're lying. But that, to me, is like the biggest red flag for an attorney, that if you go in, they're like, well, I've never lost in court. In 23 years, I have lost in court. And there are some times I should have lost. Part of selecting a good attorney is finding the right fit for you. Like, there are different specialties of doctors, right? There's a urologist, there's a difference even in those categories. And if you go to an OBGYN, there's OBGYNs that specialize in particular areas of being an OBGYN. Lawyers are the same. Yes, family law is a subsect, right? But within that subsect are lots of different areas. For example, I don't do prenuptial agreements. It's part of family law. I don't touch them. I don't really touch postnuptial agreements, even though that's part of family law. So that's not my specialty. So you really want to find an attorney that is familiar with the type of situation you are dealing with, because that is an important perspective to have. And I think that comes up quite often, like parental alienation cases, which is a whole other hot button topic about what is alienation, if it exists. And I mean, we could spend 2 hours talking about that. But that being said, if that's what's going on in your case, you need an attorney that knows about parental alienation and knows the 17 factors that are used to determine whether there is parental alienation, and knows the experts and knows who to use and not to use as experts. And so you really need to find someone that matches your situation, that knows how to handle your situation. There's a difference between a $500,000 marital estate and a $9 million marital estate for how the attorney handles it. And so you got to find someone that's experienced in the different areas. And so you really need to find someone that can handle whatever it is that your particular issue is. And it's going to become really clear when you're talking about specific questions, whether they answer them or not. I mean, you're going to know. Trust your gut. If you think the person's an idiot, then make your calls. Y'all, just like there's great mechanics and bad mechanics, there's good podcasters, there's bad podcasters, there's good teachers, bad teachers, there are good lawyers and there are bad lawyers. That's just the reality of it.
As a client, how do you stay informed and empowered throughout this process?
Well, you stay involved with your attorney. Everyone gets concerns about the cost of an attorney, which, I'm not gonna lie, we're expensive. And the ones that are expensive and are really good at what they do are worth every penny in a courtroom, I can assure you.
What advice would you give to someone who has to represent themselves in family court?
Don't. I mean, that's real. I'll never forget this. This was probably 10 years ago. Someone said, well, I can go into court and represent myself, right? And it was a pretty serious like allegation that had been made. And I said, well, unless you can go to law school in the next 3 days and learn all the knowledge that I have, I said, you can do it. I wouldn't recommend it. There's too many traps in family law to do it by yourself. There's too much emotional enmeshment in your life to do it yourself. You can. I just wouldn't recommend it.
What's something that you wish more people understood about family court and how it really works?
There are lots of four-letter words in family law, and fair is not one of them. Do not go to court to expect a fair result. And here's the other one. You are never going to get the pound of flesh that you feel you deserve, ever. You are never going to walk out of that courtroom feeling they got theirs. It's not designed for that. And in fact, you will most likely walk out of court unhappy. And it's for a couple of reasons. One, it's you never get the results you expect. Number two, things are said in court that you can't come back from. And so if you've sat in a contested trial for 3 days, 4 days, a week, 2 weeks, and you hear someone trashing you, this is a quote from court. The guy said that she had more hail damage on her thighs in Kansas City, referring to her cellulite. You can't come back from that. The last thing that you really need to remember is that going to court and having a stranger decide your life is something you should try to avoid at all possible costs, because they are never going to hear the full story. They're never going to hear the small details, because there simply isn't time. You are looking at best on a trial day, 6.5 hours of testimony. That's usually tops. I'll tell you, it's probably about 5 hours of actual testimony in court. And so you are asking a person who doesn't know your life, doesn't know your kids, and doesn't know you or what you've been through to make life-altering decisions for you. Now, I say that because sometimes you have no choice. And if you have no choice, you need to make sure that the attorney that you have is a litigator, because there are two very different types of attorneys. There are ones that go into court or litigators, and there are not. And that's not a bad thing. That's just, there are surgeons and there are general practitioners. I mean, that's just how it is. And so if you have to go to court, and I find that typically if you end up in court in a final trial, one of the parties has a personality disorder. I'm not diagnosing anyone. I can't. I can just tell you, generally speaking, there's something wrong. But if you have to do it, make sure you're armed with the best. And I will tell you this, because it's money that will be well spent, because the negative consequences could be much worse.
So, Michelle, what is something you wish more people understood about how family court really works?
That there is never enough time to get your story out. And I say that because I've done litigation for 23 years, my 23rd year being a litigator. In court, when you're actually in trial, you are going to get at most 6.5 hours of testimony a day. Typically here in Central Texas, it's about 5 hours of testimony a day. And y'all, 5 hours goes by fast. And there is never enough time to get into all of the information, all the nuances of your relationship. Your attorney's job is to hit the legal high points, and that's never going to leave you satisfied, because the whole time you're like, well, what about this? What about this? And your attorney simply just can't get into it all. That being said, if you don't reach an agreement, you are literally asking and turning your life over to a person who doesn't know you, doesn't know your life, and they're going to make the decisions regarding asset and wealth assignment. They're going to make decisions regarding how you can parent your children. They're going to make decisions over time with your children. And so it's really important to see, to get an agreement if you can. And if you can't, buckle in, because it's going to be an unpleasant ride. And no one has ever walked out of court happy.
The parties that are represented in court, how often are they surprised by the permanent nature of the things that they say or do in court becoming something that could later on down the road jeopardize what their goals are?
So here's the real problem is, as a party, you're not going to know the law. You're not going to know what the case law says in your state. You're typically not going to know where the pitfalls are, right? Your attorney will. And so that's why I often tell clients, I said, trust me to do my job. No offense to you. You don't know family law. I do. So I'm going to work to hit the points that I know legally we need to hit. It may not be everything you want to get out and in front of the court, because the court's not going to care about that. And that's a really hard thing for them to hear, because they're like, what do you mean the court's not going to care about that? Because it's so important to them. But I know what the law says, and the court's not going to care. And so I think people very much have a hard time with, well, what do you mean the judge didn't care that he had an affair? That one's the hard one. That one's the hard one is, well, but he did it. I understand. He assaulted me and he's still going to get part of the assets. Sorry. And so yeah, I think that's hard for people. Well, that's not fair. And that's why I always tell them, remember when I first met you, I told you lots of four-letter words in divorce. Some begin with F, but it's not fair.
How has the duality of both your position as a former judge and a lawyer impacted the decisions you make when you're facing both entities in court?
I'm a much better lawyer because I was a family law judge for several reasons. Because I've seen the different perspective to understand that you aren't always right. Your positions may not always be correct. And what I think is interesting, and this is probably where I'm at in my career, but it's, judge, here's my legal argument. I just need a ruling. And it's not personal. It doesn't matter to me sometimes what the ruling is going to be. I just need the ruling. And so I can get the record made clear if I need to appeal. And that was a definite transition because when I was a much younger attorney, well, what do you mean the judge didn't sustain it or overruled my objection? I wasn't as understanding that you're not always going to be right. And you also understand a different perspective because you're going to see there are two sides to the story. And the truth is, as one of my friends told me, there's actually three sides. It's the each party side and then the truth is somewhere in the middle. And the courts really focus on the kids. And so being a judge made me such a better attorney. And also, I learned not to take it so personally. When I was a younger attorney, I probably took it way more personally than I should have. And now there are times where I get rulings that I may not like, but I can understand why the judge did it. And that's super helpful for me to kind of explain it to my clients of like, well, here's what they may have been thinking. And you never know, but it gives me some clarity and it gives me the ability to not take it so personally. Because I'm like, I just need a ruling, judge. Just need a ruling. Whatever it's going to be, I just need it. And that's a definite change in my practice. Before, I would argue and argue and argue. I think I had one judge recently, I was like, judge, I've already made my legal argument. It's not going to change. I don't know what else you want me to say. I just need a ruling.
What's the one piece of advice you'd give to someone entering the family court system for the first time?
Breathe. It's going to be a long process. It's not quick, no matter how quick you want it to be. And so hold on, get ready, and remember that even though it's a challenging process, you will get through it. And most importantly, no one leaves a divorce case thinking, man, that was fun.
If someone wants to research more, what are the resources that you would recommend for people navigating family law issues?
The first thing I would say is go to your local law library. Those law librarians are wonderful at pointing you in the right direction. I remember when I was studying for the bar exam, I spent 8 hours a day for 6 weeks in the law library studying. I remember all the people that would come in day after day after day asking for, it's not really legal advice because I can't give legal advice, but asking for help. And so your local law library will have a lot of resources. I would also look on whatever state organization that runs your attorneys, whatever state bar it is, they will have resources. A lot of states now are producing standard forms for people to use. And so you can go online to most of those states and find the forms that you may need to use for court. I think now we actually have a prescribed form now for protective orders in Texas that we didn't used to have for the petitions, that is. That's really the top two. I will caution people. Family law is very, very fact specific. And when I say fact specific, you could have two identical cases, but one small detail is different, and that can completely change the outcome of your case. And the state matters. Also, what I hear a lot is, well, my brother, sister's, cousin's, uncle's best friend had this happen to them in court. Don't listen to that. You don't know the facts. You don't know the minutiae. You don't know the state. You don't know the judge. You don't even know if you're getting the whole version of what actually happened. So don't do that. And find someone that can properly advise you. And then be careful of the social media groups. Be careful.
That brings us to a good point. How much would you favor or caution people when they're seeking legal advice from TikTok, YouTube, even AI?
Oh, AI is a fun one. AI is very useful. I believe that if we don't adapt to AI, we're going to get left behind, especially in the legal profession. So I use it. I am not by no means an expert on it. And by no means do I rely on it in what I do. It is a starting point at times for me to get into whatever direction I need to get into for whatever reason. That being said, AI isn't always right. I've had a client send me basically how to handle a hearing and all the evidence I need to put together because he's trying to help me. And I so much appreciate that he did that. I mean, I already knew what I was going to do, but I understand his stress and anxiety level with this case and why that was important for him to send. And I'm glad he did it. But then we got our judge assignment and I told him, I'm like, well, AI doesn't know our judge. I do. And here's what's going to happen. And so I just caution people on AI for that particular reason, because family law is nuanced. It also depends on the mood the judge is in that day. I mean, really, it is... AI can't predict that. So be really careful when you're asking AI questions. Also, there have been cases out there where lawyers have been sanctioned for using AI because the AI is coming up with case law that doesn't exist. And so they're not verifying that it's in fact true. I had a trial, a jury trial. Oh, this was a little while back in court. And the defendant, who's representing himself, was using ChatGPT to cross-examine the officer on the witness stand. And so at some point, the defendant asked for a minute. And I said, sure, go ahead and consult ChatGPT before you proceed. Because that's what he was doing. And I just, you can't stop it. But yeah, so AI is definitely changing things. But I would caution on the social media groups. I'd caution on especially religious organizations when your church leaders are coming in and giving legal advice. I'd be really careful because I have seen, and they're well-intentioned, right? Like I'm not, please understand, I'm not saying that they're awful or their malintent is to when they do those things. I believe they're good intention. But some of those recommendations they have you follow can hurt your case in court. I've seen it happen too many times. And so I will caution people with those types of your church leaders, your pastors, the social media groups, the mom groups, there are so many groups out there. Just be careful. And more importantly, don't sign anything until a lawyer has reviewed it. And if whoever it is you are going up against or whoever it is that is presenting it to you says, you need to sign it now, your answer is, I just need time to read this, please. You don't sign anything. And that's not legal advice. That is just generally smart advice. Jake, as always, thank you so much for helping me kick this off. I couldn't have asked for a better way to start this journey, and I wouldn't be here doing it without you. We'll be back on July 1st with our first full episode. And since you've made it this far, I'll let you in on a little preview. It involves Brad Pitt. We're diving into Brad's first high-profile divorce, the legal strategy behind the headlines, and the moves I would have made if I were on the case. And remember, there are lots of four-letter words in family law, and fair isn't one of them. Until then, I'm Michelle Locke, and this is Love, Lust, Law. Love, Lust, Law is hosted by me, Michelle Locke. Executive produced by Jake Deptula. Produced, written, and researched by Haley Gray. Sound editing and mixing by Jared Landis. Want to find out more about what I'm doing? You can follow me on Instagram at Attorney Michelle Locke or email me at hello@michellelocke.com. Just remember, Michelle has one L, and you can thank my mother, Margot, for that.